BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why is it the British Army Psychological Warfare officers are getting paid 20 times more working in strategic communications? Plus, Filton Airfield, we ask, how can it make sense to chase Airbus and Rolls-Royce out of town? And from the European Particle Research Centre near Geneva, CERN, our guest went on to set up the Forum for Stable Currencies. Now, Sabine McNeill is campaigning for victims of miscarriages of justice. But first, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, is back to discuss this whole business of strategic communications. Martin, can you tell us what is this whole area? Because it seems that there's quite a lot of people who've been being trained by the military up at 15 UK PSYOPs, which is a part of the British Army, in Chicksands in North London, and finding their way into these big, powerful strategic communications companies, obviously being tempted in by the massive salaries. Are we talking about being paid 20 times more in this private business than they were when they were working for the Army?
Yeah, and the Army trained them at our expense. I would argue if somebody has been trained at British taxpayers' expense to be a psychological warfare officer, they are not to sell that on the open market. That's not the business.
But you can't force people where they're going to work. It's very much like,
the mercenaries. Sign the Official Secrets Act, don't you? And you say you can't say anything what you've been involved in and so on.
You would actually
so
need
forth.
Evidence in order to prosecute them. What I'm saying here is, effectively, this is a sort of parallel, really, with the way that soldiers are trained, the army, to fight, and then they find that they're offered rather more money, 20 times more, not being a surprising amount, working for a private business, like somebody like Blackwater.
Yes, but Blackwater, of course, is ultimately dependent on contracts from the government. And what Blackwater should be, what have happened should be Blackwater or Shea or whatever they're now called, is they should simply be liquidated. If you're going to have a military, and I suppose we've got to have one, it should be run with a line of accountability directly to the elected politicians, and nobody else should get their finger in the pie. Nobody. Military operations and things of that sort are far too dangerous to be left to the private market. And we don't want all of these people charging around the place with military training that's been gained at taxpayer expense and then selling their stuff to the highest bidder. We used to have a rule in this country that no British citizen could enrol in foreign armies. Nobody. Yeah, it's illegal to do that. And I think that's absolutely right. Otherwise, why can't the Chinese buy our ex-military?
Well, you'll be saying next that we can't have Spanish football players in our football teams.
No, because football's a different matter. Football is a sport, football's a game, football's an industry. Military activity is killing people, and it's not a game, and it's not to be done for sport or for fun.
But I mean, the French Foreign Legion was very successful for centuries. You know, that's because
the French Foreign Legion got a tremendous reputation for brutality in Algeria in the 1950s. They are basically professional in one way only, that they are mercenaries. Now, mercenaries are mercenaries, okay?
They've been around since the Napoleonic, before that.
They've been around for a very, very long time. And we've had to fight, many times we've had to, the people who are mercenaries have had to be fought down by people who are not mercenaries. We want a volunteer army with people who are dedicated patriots, and that is all. People who want to make money shouldn't join the army. That's not what it's about.
But this is actually really effectively a kind of bigger scale version of public relations. Now, we've seen many times, you know, people go from journalism, you know, they're trained up to work for the BBC or whoever, and then they go into PR. They start working for big corporations, and that is basically their expertise is bought by that corporation. Whoever it is, it might be, say, for example, British Aerospace or British Airways, somebody like that, mate, buys in that expertise to give them a bit of insight in how to best get their message across in the media. There's nothing wrong with that,
no,
surely.
There's nothing wrong with that in principle, but don't forget, military is military, which is quite different from most other things. It's about killing people, basically, at the end of the day, and manipulating their minds
but
in
the
order to put them in a position where you can kill them.
The strategic communications firms are actually, although they do get involved in war, and about the way that wars are communicated, they're mainly to do with things like advising political parties when it comes to fighting elections.
Yes, and of course, who's paying for that? The question is, who pays for all of this stuff? ultimately, it's ultimately taxpayers. Say the political party wins the election, then it gives the contracts to the people that help them to win it. And this is one of the problems we've got with politics as a whole, is it's been saturated with dirty money, and the dirty money pays well. But I would suggest that if people join the British Army and become psychological warfare people, then the real danger is that they use their connections inside the structure to gain advantages which they shouldn't be able to do. Secret operations should be secret. Everything military should be run in-house, because it's killing people. It's not something to be making a profit out of. But prisons shouldn't be run for a profit.
But Martin,
I'm
talking about things like corporate communications, and I'm talking about public relations. I'm not talking about killing people. I mean, one of the companies that do this.
Ultimately about killing people. Winning elections often involves bumping off the wrong people to make sure that they don't stand in the election, like in Colombia. That's what we mean by. That's what we're really talking about here. Yeah, let's get real about what psychological warfare operations is all about. Some of it's about PR and some of it's about dirty tricks.
One of the companies that does get involved in strategic communications is called Bell Pottinger. There was a story towards the end of last year when the Independent newspaper dug out some information which was basically leaks showing that these people were boasting about all sorts of access to the very top people, getting the high level meetings going within a matter of days between, for example, Chinese ambassador and British officials. So they're obviously operating at quite a high level. But we had another story about it this week, which is to do with Prince Andrew's aide. This was in the Daily Mirror, in fact. A lobbying company which boasted about its links to the royal families hired the son of Prince Andrew's most trusted aide. Bell Pottinger has taken on Harry Watson, whose father, Major Alastair Watson, is the Duke of York's powerful private secretary. The link to the prince has been exposed after executives from the public affairs giant were filmed boasting about their royal connections in an undercover sting. The chairman, David Wilson, suggested Bell Pottinger might be able to help organise an overseas royal tour, and even mentioned claims that Andrew would follow where the checkbook is. Now, Tamasin Cave from the Alliance for Lobbying Transparency Pressure Group said people will be concerned. The royal family are being unwittingly dragged into the shadowy lobbying world. Seems that Bell Pottinger's tentacles reach everywhere. This is a firm that represents overseas governments with dubious records, Sri Lanka and Bahrain, to name just two. We need to know whether the prince himself is aware of this connection to them.
Well, that's right. And of course, as I've said before on this programme, the government of Bahrain is a royal dictatorship, and we've made our position about dictatorships in the Middle East absolutely clear in the Libya business, isn't it? They should all be shot through the head after being sodomised with bayonets. Isn't that correct? We're in favour of bloody revolution all the way. Negotiations, forget it. We said to Gaddafi, no negotiations. We're saying to Assad, no negotiations. It's up against the wall to be shot. Now, that means that the whole of the Bahraini royal family, I'm just following through the logic of the British government's position, should be put up against a wall and shot, and anybody who has anything to do with them, and that would include our own royal family, it would appear, up against a wall and shot after being sodomised with a bayonet. It's the only way.
Martin, I don't think we need to go into that sort of language.
I'm just pointing out the reality of the British government's position.
OK, the MPs today have been questioning Saudi arms contracts because the Prime Minister is in Saudi Arabia today. He's arrived for talks as an influential group of MPs raised questions over British arms deals with the country. Cameron's meeting King Abdullah at his Riyadh palace for discussions. Downing Street hopes will broaden and deepen the UK-Saudi relationship. Saudi Arabia is Britain's biggest trading partner in the Middle East, with bilateral trade worth $15 billion a year and Saudi investment in the UK worth more than $62 billion. But Mr Cameron's first visit to the nation since becoming Premier came as the Committees on Arms Export Controls published details of questions it's raised with the government over the licensing for a range of equipment. Export permissions was granted for bomb equipment, components for military combat vehicles and helicopters, weapon sites and communication technologies. MPs questioned why, given the unrest in Saudi Arabia last year, licences had not been revoked as part of the government's review of arms sales.
Quite so. And let me stress again, we're beyond the liberal thing of not selling arms to them. The British government's position was made clear in the Libya campaign. Any despot in the Arab world who is not properly elected, Gaddafi, the King of Saudi Arabia, whoever, they must all pay the price through bloody revolution.
But there isn't the same sort of uprising in Saudi Arabia as there were in Libya.
There is in Bahrain. We're just not hearing about it. But the Saudi army are occupying Bahrain and have bulldozed scores of Shia mosques. and it's all there on the internet. That's what they do.
So what should Mr. Cameron be saying to Prince Abdullah in Saudi Arabia today?
Well, maybe what role did your King secret Abdullah service play in 9/11, when 19 of the hijackers were supposedly from Saudi Arabia? They were all given visas by the CIA from the embassy in Riyadh, for example. Now, in actual fact, there's a whole can of worms in Saudi Arabia, isn't there? A whole can of worms. Now, ultimately, all of these pro-Western regimes will have to be swept away, and they'll have to have the same treatment as Gaddafi, won't they? Let's follow the logic of the British government's position through. We'll send our special forces in to help the rebels, and if they get up against tanks or whatever, we'll send the RAF in to knock out the tanks, won't we? Oh, no, we won't. We're going to supply the other side. Now, if I was a young Saudi patriot, I'd say, right, the enemy of my enemy is my enemy, and therefore all British senior politicians and their military are my enemies, and we're at war with them. So get ready at Chick Sands for a few bombings, eh? That's the future. That's the way we're going. That's what Britain wants. Britain believes in war. We like war. But, of course, we think it's all going to happen somewhere else.
Well, talking,
not on our doorstep.
Talking of war, one of the big events this week was the bombing in Tehran. An Iranian nuclear scientist was attacked. In fact, there are a whole catalogue of attacks. Six now, nuclear scientists in Iran have been murdered, either shot dead or blown up in attacks by outside agencies, actually within Iran itself. Now, you know, many people might see that, Martin, as an act of war,
as well as
potentially, anyway, of these kind of boycotting, which is being this can possibly happen later on this year, the boycotting of Iranian oil. Now, the method of assassination was all too familiar: the motorcycle with a pillion passenger, the magnetic bomb, and the lifeless body left in the car. This is the fifth attack on an Iranian nuclear scientist. In four cases, including Wednesday's assassination of Mustafa Ahmadi Rosan in Tehran, the results have been fatal. What's different this time is the level of tension that surrounds the murder. So I wonder if you could talk about maybe the economic side of this, because there is immense pressure on Iran right now to conform, to avoid having basically a boycott by the whole of the Western world and Europe.
The boycott's already in place, which is, of course, an act of war, and the Iranians say, well, OK, we're not going to sell our oil to you. But if you're going to... I mean, the assassination of these nuclear scientists is an evil act anyway, an act of war. But also, of course, the Western intelligence services are supporting Jundullah, who are a Sunni terrorist group in Balochistan. They're supporting Mujahideen al-Haq, who are based in Iraq, who are also another terrorist group that carry out assassinations and bombings inside Iran. They're also supporting Kurdish separatists in the north part of the country to carry out bombings and assassinations. And when we talk about bombings, Jundullah bomb Shia mosques. Yeah, they are a sectarian Sunni militia, and they're getting help from our security forces. Now, of course, if I was the Iranians, I'd say, and the Iranians are behaving with commendable restraint, actually, but ultimately, when the war kicks off, if I was the Iranians, I'd come to Britain and make some mess here, just like we make mess in their country. And that might make the ordinary British people wake up and realise if you go around picking fights all over the world, you might just get what you wish for.
Well, Martin, what about this whole idea of economic warfare? It's something that we're not necessarily familiar with. We've talked about cyber warfare on this show, space warfare. These are the new kind of frontiers, aren't they?
Well, economic warfare only hurts the ordinary people. So the idea of basically making Iran scream and making poor people in Iran poorer in the hopes that they will rise up against their government is absolutely evil and wrong. That's not the way that things should be done in the 21st century. And in actual fact, despite all the huffing and puffing, independent observers showed that Ahmadinejad won the election in Iran. And in Iran, they do actually have elections, unlike in Saudi Arabia, where you can't even demonstrate in the street because it's illegal.
Well, one of the reactions to this, of course, right across the Western world has been the Occupy movement. We hear today that the Occupy Bristol group, it looks like the Bristol City Council, in agreement with the cathedral, God's representative in Bristol, the Dean, have decided that they can't stay there anymore, and they're going to go through procedures to evict them. And that was a court case which was heard today. The only trouble is the court was actually occupied by the Occupy Bristol people because the judge refused to actually give them his judgment. That is a written version of what he's actually said.
Well, the struggle goes on. As the song goes, we'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you until you do the bidding of the many, not the few.
But one criticism of the Occupy movement, Martin, including here in Bristol, is that it hasn't actually been very articulate.
Well, I think that's absolutely wrong. If you talk to them, you'll find they've got all sorts of different ideas. That's just a trope that's been put around by the national media. The national media that fill our heads with load of nonsense about X Factor, they find actually having a serious conversation about what might or might not happen a bit difficult to deal with. Basically, a lot of people are getting angry. They don't quite know what they want, but they want to talk about it, and that's what it's all about. And I was down there at lunchtime today running a Speaker's Corner event for everybody that's there, you know, passers-by, Occupy protesters, to start discussing the serious issues that need to be discussed. We're about to have a banking collapse and possibly a war with Iran that could turn into a world war. It's about time people got their fingers out and realised that we need a proper dialogue in this country and not just a series of monologues.
Well, Occupy Bristol people have left the county courthouse at the now. One of their spokespeople said that we asked the judge to produce his oath to prove his jurisdiction in this court for us. He refused to do so. We requested again and he refused to give it. Therefore, we stated we could not recognise his jurisdiction until we had seen his oath. The judge submitted a summary judgment without permitting a trial. We were not permitted a trial, so the defence were not able to actually put forward a case. They said he did not recognise the judge's ruling as he failed to provide an adhere to lawful due process for the defence of this case.
Well, I don't know the exact details of what's going on with this, but basically this is par for the course. People protest, there are court cases, the court cases are part of the protest. Of course, the people will eventually move, but they'll just go somewhere else. And as the banks collapse and the economy goes into the tank in the later in this year, lots of ordinary people are going to be joining those demonstrators in the streets, I can assure you.
Okay, we're going to be talking about Filton Airfield and the closure, at least the planned closure, by the end of this year, after some music from Stereolab. From 1994, that's Stereolab. The sound was, that one was called Ping Pong, all about the economy pinging and ponging backwards, and loads of rich people making lots of money out of it as it does so. Now I'm rejoined by Martin Farmer, who's from Cadbury Heath Ward. He's a parish councillor. Martin, could you just give us your take, essentially, on what's now the prospects, really, for the sell-off of Filton Airfield for housing? We're being told it's going to be sold by the end of this year. Is that going to happen?
If I sort of give the, I suppose, give the listeners a bit of background as to what's actually happened over the last, probably over the last few weeks, there's a lot of misinformation out there in the press, particularly with regard to the vote that took place in Kingswood on the 19th of December. Basically, what happened just before the 19th of December, there was a number of parish and town councils that actually voted to save the airfield. Some of those parish councils are actually Conservative-led, have got a number of Conservative South Gloucestershire councillors on the parish. On the 19th, the Labour Party went into the South Gloucestershire meeting, made an amendment to say that they wanted to save the airfield, and they were actually voted down by the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, some of which actually supported the airfield previously in the votes that they made at the parish level. And even some of those councillors who voted against Labour actually made some submissions to actually save the airfield just prior to that.
But what about the prospects generally? I mean, do you think it's a done deal? I mean, because unfortunately, I mean, this is owned by BAE Systems, who in the 1980s got it for free, essentially, because of the privatisation of the British Aircraft Corporation, I believe, who owned it at the time. Because it was nationalised to begin with, then it was denationalised and given to BAE Systems. So they haven't really earned that ground, the grass underneath.
They haven't earned it at all. The problem we've got is BA Systems is a defence company. It's a defence company that basically all defence companies are going through some difficult times at the moment, and BA Systems is not into running airfields. So it wants to turn that airfield into cash as quickly as possible for its shareholders. Full stop. It's a public limited company. Is that what public limited companies do? Yet I think BA Systems were well coached by South Gloucestershire over the years. Yet we're facing some big headwinds, I must admit, but we're now going into the next phase of the campaign, and we're going to now have to persuade the inspector that, you know, the airfield needs to remain.
But I mean, ultimately, this is a decision which really should be down a planning decision, down to, I mean, BAE Systems approach South Gloucestershire. So they want to do this. South Gloucestershire then decide whether they are allowed to or not, and they've said yes.
I think one of the issues is that we're looking at this in a very, very fragmented approach. I think we've written to the Transport Minister, and basically there's no national strategy about assets that as valuable as Filton Airfield. We've just seen it down in Plymouth. The airfield's been closed there. Filton Airfield could be closed at the end of the year, and those are basically assets. We'll never see another airfield built, major airfield built in the UK, and that's something that's really sad, and that's something that's not good for the UK as a whole.
Now we're also joined by a local resident of Filton, that's Leslie Cox, who lives in Stoke Gifford. Now, Leslie, I'm just shocked to see that there's someone who lives right next to an airfield that's prepared to come and say how she wants to keep it. Most people actually don't like airfields because they're so noisy.
Well, that's probably true, although it's not the case in for Filton Airfield. I think the thing that I cannot understand, I'm a proud Bristolian. Bristol is built on light engineering. One of the things that it has been involved in over the years and has been important to it is the aircraft industry as part of that light engineering. So much spins off from that. Filton Airfield is a unique asset. It's the longest in the run in the country. It's, if not the oldest, it's one of the oldest. It has a huge history. And it's an absolute outrage that somebody can come along and just say, we're going to close it. It's a unique resource that's going to be destroyed by a commercial entity at the expense of the community, when they clearly have no more commitment to this community. In addition to that, how can such an important resource just be taken away from us, from the nation, from the community, the local community, because somebody says so, without any kind of public inquiry, national public inquiry, without any a royal commission, some kind of public debate where people can actually see all of the evidence that is claimed to be out there? And the reason I say this is because I've been to public meetings And I've listened to people. I'm nothing to do with the aircraft industry. I have no connection with it whatsoever. But I've been to public meetings and I've listened to the evidence. And the evidence that's being put forward by British Aerospace is so thin, it's virtually non-existent. And it,
well, they're saying, for example, Leslie, that they can't make money at the place. This is the essential thing, that, you know, this is a commercial business. They have to make money, and they cannot make money at Filton. It's just simply not possible.
Well, actually, the evidence doesn't show that to be the case. I mean, the evidence that they were lying about that was found very easily by Radio Bristol, who quite quickly turned up that last year, for example, it made 1.3 million. There is a huge amount of evidence that the airport is being deliberate or has been deliberately run down in order to make it less profitable, so that a killing could be made in terms of profit from the sale of the land, which, as we've already established, they don't deserve. It was given to them. They have no right to that land. It should really be given back to the community, to the people of Bristol, to the workers who have actually been involved in making that a profitable industry. The evidence that it is could be a going, the evidence that it was a commercially successful enterprise, that it is a commercially successful enterprise, that it would be a commercially successful enterprise, is very strong. At these public meetings, expert after expert stood up and produced the evidence which showed that this was a profitable exercise, and there were various forms of new types of business that could be brought in to make this a profitable exercise. Again, despite British Aerospace's attempts to run it down.
And Les is quite right. Last year, the airfield made £1.3 million. The government, in its own assessment of the airports around London, has actually said that those airports are actually filling up. So there is significant, in fact, fantastic opportunities for an airfield like Filton, not to become a major international airport, but to actually win business that basically is now going to be driven out of Heathrow, Gatwick, Stansted, Luton, into other airfields. We're missing a massive opportunity.
Now, I was actually down at Filton Airfield just before Christmas, and I spoke to a chap who's a former de Havilland aero engineer. I would say actually probably one of the best aero engineers in the country. He spends most of his time looking after, what should we say, vintage aircraft, things like the old Mustang, and there's another aircraft called, which you might have heard of, called the Spitfire. He's one of the only people who can actually build original parts for the Spitfire. And so let's have a listen to what he has to say. I asked him particularly about the massive three-prong, it's got three enormous bays, this massive Brabazon hangar, which was built just after the Second World War, when it looked like there was a real big future for building, because actually someone was telling me, I think it was from the Bristol Aero Collection, that at the end of World War II, the companies at Filton and associated plants were actually building more aircraft than anywhere else on the planet at the end of the Second World War. Also, it was a Bristol built aircraft that was the first one, a Bristol Blenheim, that actually went into enemy territory at the beginning of the Second World War. And so I asked him about, particularly about this massive hangar, and whether or not it was listed, but also why it was that such an enormous resource couldn't be used. So anyway, let's have a listen now to aero engineer John Hart, who's based up at Filton Airfield right now.
My name's John Hart. I'm the chief engineer of the Aero Museum. We look after and rebuild vintage airplanes. Amongst those, Spitfires and the Mustangs are our principal aircraft. The hangar is massive. You can put in the three bays a total of, I believe, 6 747s, and you can get 4 in the centre bay. The previous people to rent that area were MK, and they flew nothing but 747s and DC-9s. It's a very large area. It's very attractive to several large companies that I've been told about. The big problem is that they want a lease longer than BA Systems are prepared to give them.
Well, that's a pity, isn't it? Because that could be actually a massive earner for Filton.
It could be, because the firm that used to do painting in the end bay used to bring large aeroplanes in to paint them, and I know that the revenue from their landings alone was quite colossal. some of the companies that want to come here. The chap who owns the Dyson Empire, I know that he's made offers to support and make buildings and so on, but the company BA Systems don't want to encourage anything more than a year, I believe. If you're looking at an account sheet and you're just basically looking to make some quick money to appease your shareholders, then you're probably going to try and sell it.
And what's going to happen if it all gets covered with housing?
I don't know where these people are going to get the money from to be able to buy these houses when there's nowhere to be employed. I also think that if the number of houses in this area actually are built, I don't know how anybody's going to be able to move their cars around this area, because it's pretty gridlocked anyway, it's going home time. And that's why British Aerospace, Rolls-Royce and the Ministry have got different shutting times in the evenings to try and alleviate some of this traffic. If you've got 3,500 houses here, plus whatever was on the North Field is going to be built, I think the place is going to be pandemonium.
That was former de Havilland aero engineer John Hart, who has a little hangar up there where he repairs, one of the only people in the country who actually can repair and rebuild vintage aircraft.
Well, I think he's absolutely right. I think there is a collusion going on between British Aerospace and South Gloss, in South Gloucestershire, in the sense that, you know, they published their core strategy shortly before the decision was announced about the closure of the airfield. And in that core strategy, they mentioned quite frequently and very importantly that the airfield was vital to the prosperity of the area and the vitality of the area. And so you have to ask yourself, why did it suddenly change? If the airfield was so important and protected at all cost, why was it suddenly different in the flash of an eye? In addition to that, South Gloss have been very happy to accept what BAE have said about their loss-making at the airfield. And they really had to be pushed to get any kind of independent study done to confirm whether or not they were telling the truth about the loss of making at the airfield. And when they did eventually carry out a so-called independent study, it couldn't have been anything more than a paper exercise, because it was over in a flash. And you can't actually undertake a rigorous study that really examines the evidence in such a short time. Therefore, it had to be nothing more than a paper exercise. And as far as the housing is concerned, he's absolutely right, because South Gloss are now known as the Concrete Council. If there's a patch of land anywhere or a blade of grass, South Gloss will build on it. And they have built from Horfield all the way through. They're now going to build in Harry Stoke. They're coming through Stoke Gifford, up through Little Stoke. They've already built Bradley Stoke, but that's continuing to expand. They've built in Patchway, and now they want to sweep all the way down the runway to the building that's going on at Cribbs Causeway and the building at the other end of the runway. And they are going to be sitting on the biggest slum in history, because this housing is very ugly, poor quality, high density and awful. And you already can't move around there. Never mind if you put in another how many thousands of houses. You lose the employment, because the industries that are around the airfield as they stand at the moment, those engineering industries that have been there for so long, such as Rolls-Royce, they will go. They will fade once the airfield's there, those industries will go. Why do they need to be there? You know, it's not rocket science. They will give pledges now that they'll stay, but the reality is that they will go. Those jobs will be lost. And he's right. Who is going to buy those houses? Where's the population going to come from to buy those houses? Because there is no employment.
But the thing is, Leslie, there's demands, massive demands on housing right now, right across the country. And surely they've got to go somewhere.
Well, they have got to go somewhere, but I mean, you also have to question whether this demand for housing is quite as big as people make out. We are constantly importing people from around the world, whether they're from you know, Australia or Zimbabwe, from A to Z. We are constantly bringing in people who are welcome. We've always welcomed people here. It's great that people from different cultures come here. That's not the problem. But we also have to have the employment for them. And at the moment, we're creating a gap because we've got a lot of people coming in and not enough jobs for them. But we're also destroying the things that can produce jobs.
Yep. Just a second, Martin. So I want to put this to Leslie, because yeah. I wonder if you're not just being a bit unrealistic, because Britain is not the industrial power that it used to be. And, you know, we do have a demand on land which changes over the years.
Sure. I can appreciate that. But then, you know, you can't really just expect a country to succeed if it's one big dormitory. You have to have something that drives it. You have to have something to support it. So... it is really quite exasperating that such an important resource that will never come again, it's the longest runway in the country, as I've said, with this huge history, it's such an important resource that could be used so well that it really is quite criminal that it can be in effect stolen from the people of the community without a by your leave.
I think Les has made a couple of good points there. I think the whole thing about people do need to live somewhere. I think from what I understand, only 8% of the land in the UK is actually built on. 8%, that's all. But I think there's a problem in South Gloucestershire. South Gloucestershire view themselves as a rural council, and they see the land that is south of the M4 basically is a dumping ground. A dumping ground for houses, so that South Gloucestershire, north of the M4, can keep their green and pleasant land. I think if we had a greater Bristol council, I don't believe we would find ourselves in the real bad situation now that we're going to use a very valuable asset, an asset that's valuable not only to Bristol but also to the rest of the United Kingdom. And I think just another point that Leslie made about the independent study that South Gloucestershire or a consultancy on behalf of South Gloucestershire undertook, which basically was really a cut and paste from a study that BAE Systems made, a study that basically said there's no viability for the airfield into the future. Basically, nobody, including BAE Systems, has actually looked at the viability of the airfield. They've entered into contracts that are just completely unsustainable for both the companies that were at the airfield and any new company that actually wants to come onto the airfield. So there's two. Yeah, to summarise, two issues. One, business could come to that airfield, but BAE Systems basically haven't gone and pursued it. And being somebody who's in aerospace, you don't just sit behind a desk, put up a website and send out a few brochures and expect the business to come. You've actually got to go out there and actually get the business. And I think the other key thing is that, yeah, basically we're dealt a hand of fate. South Gloucestershire is a rural council. It's got no real interest in anything it's using everything south of the M4 as just a dumping ground, and has got basically no interest in industry in South Gloucestershire, in the aerospace industry in South Gloucestershire.
Now, what about this business, though, Martin? It just seems pretty naughty of BAE Systems to be telling companies, massive companies that have been there over the last sort of 5-10 years, that they can only renew their leases for a year. That really is driving business away from the airfield. It's not no wonder they're not making a profit, or they say they're not making a profit if they're actually driving business away.
Basically, BAE Systems have said that they've gone out there and tried to get business, when in fact, like I say, they haven't gone out there and tried to get business at all, or they've entered into contracts that are completely unsustainable. The aviation and aerospace business is not a 6 or 12 month business. It's a long term business where you need long term. You need somewhere like an airfield. You need a long-term lease to be able to operate off on that airfield. And I think John Hart, who's a very well-respected man in aviation in Bristol and is very well known, I think hit the nail on the head that there were certain companies that were operating out of that Brabazon hangar that were only offered very short-term leases and now have actually been driven away to other airports where they're actually now operating very, very successful successful businesses.
Seems strange, doesn't it? The Brabazon hangar is one of the only hangars in the world that can accommodate the biggest aircraft in the world.
It's unique. It's a unique facility that should be utilised when it's next to, as Leslie said, one of the longest airfields in the country. With the pressures that are being felt on the London airports, there is a significant business opportunity on that airfield, and unfortunately, BA Systems are just throwing it away because they need the cash. They're a defence company and need the cash.
And that business that could be brought in, Heathrow is busting at the seams, and whilst it wouldn't be suitable for an airport, it would be highly suitable to bring in freight. There's business there for the maintenance of aircraft. There's, whether they're military or civil, there's openings there for other kinds of manufacturing. After all, over the years, that site has produced everything from buses to prefabs, from Bristol cars, you know, not just Bristol aeroplanes, it's Bristol buses and trams and prefabs. All sorts of things have been built there with part of the engineering expertise. But the thing is, British Aerospace is now an absentee landlord. They've only really got a tiny little holding up there, and they've decamped to France, which interestingly has just been downgraded in their credit rating.
So today.
Today.
Yeah, you are up with the news. Marina Morris has been out on the streets asking some people of Bristol what they think about what's been going on up at Filton, and she also included some questions about after our New Year's revelation that the MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Conservative Jack Lopresti, is a Freemason.
Should British Aerospace be allowed to close Filton Airfield in December 2012 and sell it off for housing?
I think the aerospace is certainly important for Filton as a, you know, export and import airport, really. So no, I don't think they should be allowed to sell the airfield. I do think housing is important, but there's plenty of other green space within Bristol that could be better utilised for housing.
Because it's a very important industry for Bristol, historically. Where are people going to work in the future if this industry doesn't exist?
Yeah, I think they should be allowed to close it off. I mean, if there's no commercial aspect to the airfield, if they can't run it, then I think it's just redundant. I'd sooner see something used for it than it being left empty. So, I mean, if housing's the best use, then that's what it should be.
I suppose we need airfields, but BAE shouldn't be in operation anyway because they make weapons components for bombs. Selling it off for housing sounds like a good thing. I mean, there's a massive housing crisis at the moment, but as long as it's going to go into, you know, cheap living accommodation for, you know, people who can't afford it, then, you know, because they're cutting housing benefit, you know, it makes sense to have more housing.
We probably need more housing. If it's not profitable, then maybe, but if it is, I don't know. I mean, if it's profitable, why would you close it?
No, the economic impact in this part of the country would be massive. If we lose that, then also the UK will lose a major part of what it's got in the aerospace industry. So that would be an enormous blow to this country and this part of the country.
Is the aerospace industry in Bristol dead?
I think Bristol's very proud of its aerospace industry roots, and I definitely don't think it's dead. I think there's certainly potential for growth should they get the right investment. Well, I mean, obviously it has a history of being an export and import city, and certainly I think that, you know, Bristol's a city would like to keep its roots, so there's always potential for new investors to come to the city and try and expand on that.
No, absolutely not. No, still very, very much alive and well. If you drive through Filton, by Filton Airfield, and you see Rolls-Royce, British Aerospace, large factories, lots of people around there still working there, people getting apprenticeships, things like that.
I don't think so, because there's so much development with British Aerospace and Rolls-Royce out in Filton that, no, I don't think it's dead, especially if the airport gets its expansion plans, you know, so I think Bristol's quite thriving.
We obviously have the BA part there, we've got Airbus, we've got Rolls-Royce, we've got other parts, and it's not dead, but it's shrinking, so if you want to reverse that trend, then you've got to try and keep Filton there.
Does it matter that the new local MP for Filton is a Freemason?
I certainly think it's a bit controversial that obviously he is a Freemason, which is a well-known secret society. I certainly think there needs to be a bit more clarity on what his role is within the Freemasons, and do we know everything that we should know?
I don't think it's a problem. Membership of any society, we live in a free country, so...
Not particularly, in my opinion. From what I know about Masons, I hear they do a lot of community work.
If it's an actual fact, then I think it does matter, because decisions shouldn't be made behind closed doors.
Yeah, no, it does. It matter that if you don't know what his links are or his motivations are, then yeah, that should be questioned.
It shouldn't, and I don't know if it does.
Should he have declared his membership of the Masons?
Yes, absolutely.
Possibly. Debatable, because that might have swayed some people's opinion. A lot of people would probably still voted for him, but probably one of the things that he should probably have made public knowledge. But unfortunately, it is a secret society, isn't it? So that's the nature of the beast. He's got to keep it secret.
I don't think people should be forced to declare what they're members of or what they believe in. He's a Conservative MP, so his political views are known. I think that's probably enough for someone in the public service.
Yes, it's a secret society. It should be documented. It should be made public. But people shouldn't, in that position, should be transparent.
Yes, clarity, and you need to understand what his motivation.
I don't believe that's an issue.
Well, that was Marina Morris out on the streets asking about your views on Filton and also about the Masonic membership of Jack Lopresti, Conservative MP for Filton, and Bradley Stoke. And I just want to emphasise that I did give Jack Lopresti and his office every opportunity to comment today, but didn't return my phone calls. Martin, one of the big points being made about the whole business at Filton is that this planning decision does look a very strange decision. As we were hearing right at the very start, there's a core strategy in place to keep the airfield, and then all of a sudden the rules are changed, the goalposts shift. How can this kind of thing happen?
I think BA Systems, they're a quite successful defence company. I think they've played a very, very good marketing political game. Basically, they pulled the rug right out of underneath South Gloucestershire, literally 2 weeks after the original core strategy, I understand, was actually published. I think just losing that airfield. I think I said before, BA Systems aren't into running airfields. They need the cash, basically, just to put to the bottom line and to give to shareholders. The biggest fear that I find is that by losing that airfield, companies such as Airbus in Bristol and GKN Aerospace, they won't be able to win new business. They're basically going to be landlocked by housing. And yeah, I've been to some other plants around the world, some major manufacturing facilities that maybe some of them don't have runways next door, but on the other hand, they're not surrounded by 5,000 houses.
But hang on a minute, because Airbus say they don't necessarily need the long runway.
It was quite interesting that BA Systems at a meeting that myself and Leslie went to, I think it was back in September, said we don't need the runway, and literally 2 days later an A380 flew in for some testing. I find that quite ironic. And and also the fact that some of these big Beluga aircraft have been coming in to pick up components. I think by not having a runway, that then almost suffocates Airbus in actually winning new business.
Well, and also Airbus have a daily scheduled service from their backwards and forwards to their other plants in other parts of of Europe.
Exactly.
Can I give you the final word though on this, Leslie? Again, I'm shocked that someone who's a local resident right at the end of the runway actually wants to keep it.
Well, the thing is that there isn't another country in the world that would allow such an important resource to just be taken away. Can you imagine Germany doing it? When we said there was no call for ships, Germany went on building ships. When we said we couldn't make cars anymore, Germany went on making cars. We cannot possibly allow, and I cannot believe it is being allowed, that a major resource of this unique capacity can just be taken away from not just the people of Bristol, but also the region and the nation. And there isn't another country in the world that would allow it. And you have to ask, who gains? Who gains from this? And the answer is British Aerospace, who are going to get 300 million plus for selling the land. South Gloucestershire, who are going to get money from British Aerospace, from developers, and ultimately from the people who live in the houses. And who loses? The people of Bristol, the people of the region, the whole country, the employees who have worked on the airfield, who are now working on the airfield, who would have worked on the airfield, the whole of Britain, and ultimately history. Everybody loses because that airfield goes. And this company is being allowed, without any scrutiny, to stand up and say, oh, it's making a loss, we're going to sell it, and everybody is allowing that to happen. There should be a national inquiry, a national scrutiny of the evidence.
Now, Leslie, thank you. I said that was going to be the final word, but I'm actually going to give the final word to Martin Farmer, who's the Labour councillor for Cadbury Heath. Martin, you're part of a Save Filton Airfield campaign. Is there any prospect you're actually going to save it by the end of the year?
We're still going to work very hard to save it. I think I was going to say right at the end, basically, I think on the tape they mentioned about Jack Lopresti and belonging to a secret society called the Masons. He might belong to a secret society, but basically Jack is completely invisible. He's we never see him in Bristol Aerospace. He only turns up for photo opportunities, so he's not supporting local industry. The only time we actually do see him is when he actually opens a Boeing office in Filton. The same Boeing that basically is competing against the same products that we're actually making in Bristol. I find it very disappointing that the local MPs, and Jack in particular, who basically the airfield's right on his doorstep, hasn't actually been supporting the Filton Airfield campaign.
Okay, well, very, very quickly, Leslie.
Well, Jack Lopresti turned up at the very first public meeting. He sat in the front row and he said, forget it, it's gone, we need to concentrate on the future. And that was the last, as far as I'm concerned, contribution that he made.
Okay, well, that's local resident Leslie Cox from Stoke Gifford, and also Labour Councillor for Cadbury Heath, Councillor Martin Farmer. Thanks very much. And we're going to finish our little thing on Filton by having an extract, from a BBC Southern Eye documentary, which is all about Freemasons and the planning system. This is from a documentary called Nothing to Declare, made by BBC Southampton back in the year 2000. And after that, we will have a chat with Sabine McNeil.
The main area of concern is the planning process.
A officer in the council stopping me and saying, if you want to progress your career, you should come over there, boys, which was to where the Masonic Lodge was.
Nobody knows how many planners have joined a Masonic Lodge because membership is private. This secrecy can lead to surprises. Councillor Jim Hardman was chairman of West Dorset's planning committee until he died last year.
I went along the Bray Respects, and then it hit me, really, smack in front of me, was the symbols of Freemasonry, the dividers and the compass. And that was the first intimation I had as a group leader on West Dorset that Jim was a Freemason.
The rules of local government do not force Masonic councillors to declare their membership. But they do have to declare an interest if a Mason from their lodge submits a planning application.
The councillor should declare the interest, and he then needs to absent himself from any decision-making process involving it. He needs to keep away from it. He needs not to go to the meeting where it's being discussed. He shouldn't lobby about it behind the scenes or speak to an officer or other members about it. He should just leave it all alone and keep away from it.
Southern Eye looked at whether councillors in Dorset are following these rules. We identified 16 councillors with Masonic connections, and 13 of them are involved in planning.
Are you aware that sort of under the local government code of conduct you're supposed to declare an interest if somebody in your lodge submits a planning application?
I wasn't aware of that, no, but as far as I know, I'd never been involved with any member of any lodge.
We found an example where a fellow lodge member had submitted an application. There's no suggestion that Mr. Ames tried to influence the committee, but he did not declare an interest. Mr. Ames has temporarily resigned from the Freemasons, and he's not sure whether he was still a member at the time of the committee meeting.
I think I probably wasn't. But as I say, I take applications in the planning, on the evidence I've got, and if I'm not happy with it, I go to look at it myself and form my own opinion.
And that was an extract from the 2000 BBC Southern Eye documentary, Anything to Declare, which if you put into YouTube, you can watch that. It shows that Freemasons who are part of the planning system, and many of them were actually in Dorset when the lists were revealed of who was in the lodges, that many of them simply did not declare their interest when they really should have done, when the people that they were granting planning permission to were in the same lodge.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now I'm joined by, just before the news, by Sabine McNeil, whose train was late. Hi Sabine, welcome to Drive Time. Can you just give us a bit of a plug for some of the websites you're to do with your justice cases?
Well, the biggest website is Victims Unite. It has had over 80,000 hits since I started it in August a year ago.
And one of the things that amazes me is that you started off your career at CERN in Geneva, and this is where all this Higgs boson stuff. So what's your take on that, really quickly?
On the Higgs boson? Well, I'm afraid I know it better, because I know that and how the current scientific system is based on paper. And I've revisited it all through the eyes of programming, and I've found the answers that they are looking for, but of course they wouldn't want me. They wouldn't want to hear that from me.
Well, what about my suspicion that some of this technology is actually used for military research?
100% sure. It's not... It's very, very sad. All of my friends with whom I went skiing and so on at the time in Geneva would say, no, 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 they have nothing to do with it. But the truth is that all scientific research is connected. You can't separate. All the papers are the same journals. All the conferences are the same, whether they're military or not.
Some people say that you don't need to do atmospheric nuclear H-bomb tests anymore, because a lot of those sort of conditions can be simulated in these kinds of particle accelerators and things like the DONUT, the fission fusion projects.
Yes. Of course, the physicists have taken on this monopoly on the world view. They think they know it all, and their standard model is everything, including time.
Okay, Sabine, I'm sorry we haven't got any more time. It was really nice to talk to you. I'll have to interview you and have it in a future week. And until next week, this is Tony Gosling and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Thanks to all our guests. We're on the web at thisweek.org.uk. Coming up next is the Fresh Blood Party with Pat Hart.